What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Charles Fisher. Charles Fisher is a record producer, often referred to as the Song Doctor. He's widely known as a producer of the album Savage Garden, released in 1997 by the band of the same name, which included the number one hit song Truly, Madly, Deeply. We discuss a lot. We discuss his time with Savage Garden. We discuss his work with Olivia Newton-John and a great deal of other things as well. This one was a lot of fun, and I think you'll enjoy it. And now I give you Charles Fisher. Okay, I'm here with Charles Fisher. Charles, thanks for coming on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Glad to be.
It's my pleasure. I'm excited to track through your career and your various brushes with music history. But before we do, Charles, please tell listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm what used to be referred to as a record producer. I spent most of my life, probably from the age of 20, working in recording studios, working my way up from an assistant in the studio to being a producer. And at one point, I owned a studio myself in Sydney, in Australia. And I produced essentially Australian acts. And I was very successful at it and had a very long career. And I think the last record I made was around 2018. And since then, and then COVID hit, since then I haven't really been very active, but I feel kind of tired, to be honest. But mainly Australian acts I've been recording on, and some of them had great success all around the world, like Air Supply and Savage Garden, and some of them just had major success in our own country in Australia. And now, of course, we're, you know, I came through from vinyl to CD to audio files.
Right.
And, you know, now we're in the streaming era. So I think that I didn't do wax.
Extraordinary. Thank you, Charles. I appreciate it. So I guess winding the clock back then, Charles, how was it that you broke into the music business?
Well, I, like a lot of my generation, was very active in playing in bands all through high school. When high school finished, you know, my, funnily enough, my dream from the age of about 17 had been to work in recording studios. My goal was really never to be an on-stage performer. I was fascinated by the art of making records. I spent a lot of time as a teenager dissecting records, trying to work out who was playing what and why they were playing it and how they got the sound. And that was always my focus as a kid. And so my dream would be to get a job in a recording studio and make records. So when high school finished, this is around 1969, I went to Europe and I just bummed around, really. And I ran into a band there, and I started doing in Hungary, of all places, a Hungarian jazz rock band. And I started doing their sound live. And when I came back to Australia, I continued to do that, to do live sound. And from there, graduated into getting a job in a recording studio. And then at a very young age, at the age of about 22, 23, I started with a friend of mine to build our own studio. And we had very basic, not really professional, but semi-professional equipment in that studio. And it really started to take off. And very quickly, it became one of Australia's premier recording studios.
Wow. Excellent, Charles. Thank you. This might be an odd question, but just to kind of sort of set the table here, what would you say is the day-to-day responsibility of a music producer?
Well, I really think it's changed over the years dramatically. I think the definition of a record producer and the job, the roles that they fulfilled when I started out, are completely different to what young record producers do today. I know today when a young artist approaches a record producer, their expectations are that that producer will program the music for them and possibly play most, if not all, the instruments on the record. In my day, the role of the producer was to work out the best tunes for the artist to record, to work out the best arrangements for the artists, to do and to supervise their performance and try and grab a great performance from them. They were more of a sounding board than hands-on. So the role really has changed a lot through the decades.
Yeah, certainly.
But for me, always your overall responsibility is to, you know, make something that, knock on wood, other people will enjoy.
Right, exactly. Well, that leads wonderfully into my next question. And, you know, I suspect there's no real answer to this question as such, but I want to throw it out there. What would you say is the difference between a good song and a bad song?
Oh.
How's that for general?
You know, I did a little bit of teaching. I did some teaching for about 4 years prior to the pandemic. And I would have students ask me that very question. Hmm. They would come up to me and say, how can you tell a good song from a bad song? And one, you cannot teach that. And two, you cannot define that, you know, because it's in the ear of the, it's in the eye of the beholder, as they say, right? What is a good song for me is not necessarily a good song for you. When the Beatles started, the generation before us was calling it rubbish. You know, I have a lot of my peers that call hip hop rubbish, you know. I think what makes a song really good is that it resonates with people. And, you know, we live in an era of tribes now. Things are no longer ubiquitous, you know. Radio doesn't dominate as it did in the 60s and 70s and 80s. So we're all listening to very, very different things. And we're all in little tribes. And, you know, tribe A loves this music and tribe B hates what tribe A loves. But, you know, so I think a good song is going to resonate. It's going to make you think, make you emote. And it's different strokes for different folks. So I'm not sure that I can give you a definition of a good song beyond that, that it should do something to you. It should resonate.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Richard Marx, who I'm sure you're familiar with, he was interviewed once and he said there's two kinds of music. There's good and there's bad. If you like it, it's good. And if you don't like it, it's bad. And it's about that
basically.
Simple. Yeah.
It totally is that simple. I mean, you know, itsy bitsy teeny weeny polka dot bikini. Huge hit, was it a song? And also, you know, Bob Dylan also said, just because it's popular doesn't mean it's any good. Mm. So I don't think you can define a good song. You know, if you like it, it's good. If you don't like it, it's bad. I agree with that statement.
Yeah. So then pressing onward then, I'm just curious how you got your nickname. So you've been referred to as the Song Doctor. How did that nickname come about? Did it take many years to earn?
Yeah, it took a few years to earn. It was coined by a journalist down here. And it's because I did a series of hits in the late 70s, early 80s, where I literally doctored the songs to a very heavy extent. You know, for example, I had a big hit with an Australian band called Moving Pictures. We had a song called What About Me, which incidentally, I think went top 20 or 30 in America as well. It was on Al Corey's Network label. And it had originally been a country and western song, and I changed it into a big ballad from a boppy country and western song. The same thing with Air Supply's Lost in Love. I changed that from being a country song into the song that it became. So, you know, even in the modern era, I mean, Truly, Madly, Deeply, the Savage Garden song was originally called Magical Kisses. Hmm. And we totally changed the song in the studio, like completely. The song's Chalk and Cheese, completely different chorus, completely different lyrics. So I had the knack of seeing potential in something rather than just accepting something for the way it was presented to me. And so this journalist coined the phrase Song Doctor.
Interesting.
I made six songs well.
Yeah, so way back in 1980, as you mentioned, you helped produce Air Supply's Lost in Love. And I'd love to know how that opportunity came about and what the experience was like.
Oh, you know, actually, it was a bit of a bittersweet experience in some ways. That it first came about because it was Air Supply's last hurrah. They were signed to an independent label in Australia. They'd been with Sony and they'd had some success, but not enough for Sony to keep putting money into them. Sony dropped them. They went to an independent label and the independent label gave them a shot. This was going to be their last shot. And I had just finished doing a punk rock band called Radio Birdman. which was released in America, which Seymour Stein from Sire Records signed to his label. And somehow the A&R man, or actually was the head of the label because it was a small independent, thought that maybe I could give Air Supply an edge. So they asked me to go and work with them. And I produced it. I produced Lost in Love as part of an album called Life Support. And it did very well in Australia. And then the head of the label sold it to Arista in America. And Arista in America remixed the record. And in remixing the record and reissuing the record, originally they left my name off the label.
No. Really?
And yeah. And what they did to the record today, people would just consider it was remixed. It would be like, you know, Chris Lord Alge mixed somebody's production, you know. But in those days, it was like not the concept of remixes didn't really exist.
Hmm.
That was the not so sweet part of the entire project. So the initial releases didn't even have my name on it. But it went crazy. But it was a great experience for me. I loved doing it. The band enjoyed it, except initially the songwriter didn't like it. Initially, Graham Russell did not like the production that I had done because he thought it should just be a very simple country and western song. And I put on all these background vocals and synthesizers and electronic tom-toms and stuff like that. So initially, he didn't like it. But the rest of the band did. Actually, making the record was a great experience. We had a lot of fun doing it. Of course, later Graham came around and realized that what we had done was absolutely essential.
Yeah.
And that was Lost in Love, but I was brought in to try and give them an edge. And then they wanted to continue working with me after that record, but Clive Davis thought that a better known American producer was called for. So I didn't continue working with them at that point.
Nah.
Oh, Dan, yes, Dan, no. I mean, it happens a lot. And it happened more in those days because, I mean, I remember my first trips to America dealing with the American recording industry. It was, you know, what the hell could be happening in Australia? You know, like Australia. So I would sometimes, to get a meeting, I would sometimes sit in a record company, you know, reception area for 6 hours and then be told, oh, you've got to come back tomorrow.
Wow.
So, you know, dealing with things back in the late 70s, early 80s was a completely different experience to now where Australia is very much accepted on the world stage. But in those days, I mean, you know, Crocodile Dundee changed everything.
Put you guys on the map.
Put us on the map. And I actually did 3 songs in that movie. Yeah, I had 3 pieces of music in that movie.
Huh. Now I'm tempted to ask, what was that experience like?
Oh, that was really interesting. You know, working with movie people is a completely different trip, you know? Yeah, I mean, I had a good time doing those songs, and they even offered me shares in the movie, which I foolishly rejected. But it was they were flying by the seat of their pants when they made that movie. They had no idea what was going to happen.
Incredible. You know, I was thinking as you were talking, Charles, so I kind of want to go back to Graham. You know, you and him had, what should we call it, perhaps a creative difference. And I'm curious how you work through that, because I would imagine, me not knowing the business, I would imagine it would be left up to the singer to say, no, this is what I want and this is how we're going to do it. Is that not the case? How did that get worked out?
Well, yes and no. You know, when you're dealing with a band, you have the buffer of the other guys in the band. So if one person doesn't like it and everybody else does, you know, you've got safety numbers. Yeah. In the case of Lost in Love, that was pretty much the case. There were 2 people that were important in that band, and that was Graham and Russell, the singer. Russell loved the record. He thought what I did was fantastic. The record company thought what I did was fantastic. So even though Graham at the time didn't like what I'd done, I think, you know, like when you don't like something and everyone else around you is going, what are you talking about? It's great, it's great, it's great. You know, you might have some second thoughts or you might decide to step back a bit. He didn't put his foot down. He didn't get dogmatic about it. You know, I just remember his reaction when we did a playback of the song in the studio and he basically didn't say anything. He just stood up and walked out, you know. And I said to Russell, what's wrong? And Russell said, doesn't like it. And I said, well, what's wrong with it? And Russell said, nothing. I think it's terrific. He'll come around, you know.
Chomping at the bit to ask you this, Charles. So is it true that all your work producing the 1997 album Savage Garden was unpaid? Did I read that right?
Yes, you read that right.
Wow.
It was a spec project. They went to every label in Australia, big and small. Well, what they did was they made a demo tape, the boys, in their hometown of Brisbane, you know. They made a demo tape and they sent out demo tapes to everybody in the industry that they could think of. And basically, they only got one response, at least one positive response, and that was from a gentleman called John Woodruff. And John Woodruff was a well-known manager in Australia. And John Woodruff reacted very favorably to the demos that he heard and decided to get involved with the band on a management level. And John Woodruff took the demo tape himself then and went back to all the record companies to try and get a deal for the band. He also got rejected. So basically the band got rejected by everybody. And John was quite a good friend of mine. You know, we had this mutual friend. And John was telling him, frustrated he was because he thought the band had potential and no one was interested and he didn't know what to do. And I was going through, you know, my friend Colin Hay made an album called Peaks and Valleys. And that's like what your career is like, peaks and valleys, right?
Yeah.
So I was going through a valley in my career and I was like, you know, you couldn't give me away. And my mutual friend said, John, why don't you go and talk to Charles? Because, you know, he knows a good song and he's not doing anything. And, you know, go have a chat with him. You'll never know. So long story short, John gave me the demo tape. He gave me with 5 songs on it. I listened to it and there was one song on that demo tape. And that was pretty much the only song that made the album in the end, To the Moon and Back, which I thought was just brilliant. I just loved it. I thought it had everything. Didn't have to touch it. Great lyrics, great arrangement, great melody. So, you know, I wasn't doing anything and I had just sold my recording studio. So I said to John, look, why don't you bring them down from Brisbane and I'll take them. And I had all my recording equipment at home. Like I have now, you know, and it was before home studios, but I just had a pile of equipment at home because I'd sold my studio and I'll see what happened. So he sent them down and we hit it off pretty good. You know, the band, they knew a lot. They'd done their research on me, so they knew my background. And we just started working at home, making the record. And John said, I can't pay you. I've got no money. I've got no funding. So we just, you know, we did. That's what we call a spec deal, you know? Like my friend says, a spec deal is I expect to get paid at some point, you know?
That's good.
So we just did a royalty deal, a spec deal. If we get a deal, this is what you'll get. And, you know, we ended up making an entire album together. It took 8 months because the material, you know, with the exception of that one song, the rest of the material I had to, you know, I won't say it was bad, but it required a lot of work. The boys weren't very experienced. They knew nothing about sampling or samplers or sequences. I mean, that their knowledge, apart from their songwriting abilities, their production abilities were very, very basic. So it took a fair bit of work. But yes, I did it all at home. I had a spare room. I set up in the spare room, which was a tiny room, smaller than your average drum booth. I did vocals in my daughter's bedroom while she was at school. And we did the whole thing at home with the exception of we did 2 days in the studio, one day for a live drum kit and one day for a string section, not even full days, 2 half days. And the rest of it was all done up in my house. And then we went looking for a mixer and we went through 3 or 4 different mixers before we finally got Chris Lord-Alge involved. We flew him to Australia. We mixed the whole record in 6 days. So basically, I spent 8 days in a recording studio on that album. The rest of it was spread over 8 months in 8 months in my house.
That's incredible. I heard you on another interview say that virtually all the production was done in your house, and I almost didn't believe you.
No. It's
extraordinary.
No, it was all done at home. I had one preamp, one compressor. It was an Atari. We used an old Atari for a sequencer. I had a 770 sampler. I mean, all really early digital equipment very early, pair of speakers hanging on the wall, no console, just a monitoring thing, like a live desk for monitoring, and a 24-track. I had a 24-track from my studio, which was sitting in the hallway. And, you know, some tradesmen would come in the house and think it was a funny place to put a washing machine. And I had a 24-track in the hallway. I knocked a hole in the wall for the cable to come through to the room we were working in. And we actually ended up with 48 tracks because I filled 24 tracks up with audio. And then I had a whole bunch of things in my sampler that I ended up, when we came to mix it, I ended up dumping onto a second reel. And I never till the mix had a chance to make sure the two reels of tape would actually sync. And when we got to the studio for mixing, it was the first time I had two 24 tracks where I could actually put, and I just kept my fingers crossed that it would sync. And it did. It was locked perfectly. So we'd be working on two separate tapes without knowing that they were actually going to sync up. I just figured they would.
Well, that's incredible. Whatever that is, intuition, instinct.
Yeah, I'd like to call it experience.
Experience. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
But I remember, because this was like, you've got to remember, this is 1997 or something. I think 97. And when, you know, when we went to number one with Truly Madly Deeply, and Billboard at the time was used to do their weekly number one breakdown of, you know, producer, track, where it was recorded, et cetera, et cetera. The guy from Billboard rang me and said, look, we've got all the information except the recording studio. I need to know where you recorded it. And he said, oh, I did it at home. And he said, oh, well, we can't put that in. And I forget. I said, well, why don't you put down, you know, like private studio or home studio or something? Because the concept of recording at home was unheard of. Not necessarily unheard of, but certainly there was no major record that had been done in your house.
Wow.
Neil Young used to record in his barn and stuff like that. But yeah, the concept of recording in your living room was like, you know.
That's incredible. Yeah, you know, I'm a 90s kid, right? So it means Truly Madly Deeply just has to be one of my top five songs. It's part of the soundtrack of my generation. And we're getting back to a good song versus bad song. I'm curious, as you were making it, Charles, did you get the sense that Truly Madly Deeply would be a hit, or was it a complete surprise?
I thought it was the last song we recorded for the album, right? I hadn't even heard it. It was the last song we recorded for the album, and we needed one more song, and they played me this song called Magical Kisses, which I thought was like, you know, not really great. I mean, you know, Magical Kisses on Your Lips was basically what the concept of the song was about. And it was very fast and very boppy. But the verse, you know, was the same as it is on the final record. And I thought the verse was fabulous. When I listened to the song, I thought the verse was fabulous. So we started recording it in much the same way that the demo was, same up-tempo sort of boppy vibe. And I thought the verse was fabulous, and I thought the chord progression was really nice, you know. But I got to a point after about 2 days where I went, no, I can't do this. This is, you know, every time it hit the chorus, I was, you know, no good, no good, no good. So I stopped the tape, I sent them home, and I sat around and I thought about it. And I found a drum loop that I thought was really suited, the really suited and the meter of the verse. So I got this drum loop and I put it on tape, and the drum loop was about 6 or 7 BPM slower than what we were recording at. It had that, you know, and that drum loop is what's on the final record. So I made them come back the next day and said, look, just put down the chords, you know, just one chord to a bar. Dang, you know.
Right.
Dang, just one chord to a bar. And let's record what's good about the song and let's leave out what's bad, you know. So they had different intro and they had this different intro kept repeating, and I didn't like it, so we dropped that, and we just did the intro that is now straight into the verse. We restructured the song, and they put down, and then Darren went and sang what I liked and just left space where the chorus would have been. We dumped the old chorus but kept the chords going.
Sure.
And I just, and we, you know, so we had verse blank, this middle section. And then I said, go away now and write something different for all the spots. And it was really slow. It was like the record is now. So they went away and they wrote it. And they wrote something new and they came back the next day and I said, no good. And they went away again. I said, no good. And they were getting really frustrated with me. They were getting really angry with me. And then the third time back, they came up with that, I want to stand with you on a mountain. And I went, perfect. That's great. So we just recorded it as it was. You know, we recorded it. And then they thought it was finished and they wanted to go home because they came from Brisbane and we'd been at it for 8 months. And they were, so they went home to Brisbane and let me to finish the record. And we put on all the keyboards and the synthesizers and the guitar and, you know, and harmonies. And, but that was its genesis. And when it was finished, I knew when it was finished that it was a great song. There was just no doubt in my mind. Whether it was a hit or whether it was not a hit was not in my, it's never in my hands. Mm. And, you know, marketing is not to be underestimated when it comes to promoting something, you know, so you never know. But I thought it was a great song and I thought we did a really good job on the record. And then when Chris finished mixing it, it was fabulous. And in fact, there's two versions of the song. There's the version that made it on the Australian record. And then the A&R man at Columbia, his wisdom decided that the record should be remixed. So they replaced my drum loop with a different drum program. So there's two versions of the record. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No, I have to admit I wasn't.
So there is actually two versions of that song. There's what I call the edgy Australian version and the saccharine American version.
I love it.
And yeah, in Australia, when it comes on the radio, I never know which version they're going to play. I mean, they're so similar that, you know, if I hadn't told you it's a different version, you wouldn't have even thought about it.
I could well have heard it and just not known.
Well, you very well could have. It's the sound of the backbeat that gives it away.
Gotcha.
The American backbeat has an 808 and my backbeat has a harder edge to it.
Oh, interesting. I'm fascinated here, Charles. So, okay, so like the song is released. As you point out, it hits number one all over.
It wasn't quite that simple because it wasn't the first single that we released, Truly Madly Deeply. In Australia, it was the third single, and in America, it was the second single. But we got the same reaction to the album in America that the demos got in Australia. We got turned down by everyone. At one point, the guy at Interscope hit play, and halfway through I Want You, which was the first track, stopped his boombox and looked at us and said, I don't know why you guys are wasting my time. Pop music doesn't work in America. And showed us the door. And we had quite a lot of trouble getting a deal in America until Columbia raised it. I mean, Arista passed. Everybody passed. And even the guy at Columbia, who was the A&R man at the time, wanted to remix the entire album. And the remixes were horrible. And the band put their foot down and John Woodruff put their foot down, wouldn't let the remixes get released. And finally, the Rosie O'Donnell show forced them to release the album because she got her hands on it. And some radio stations. We had, can you believe it? There's about 3,000 radio stations across the South of America playing I Want You at the same time as Columbia were trying to remix it.
Wow.
Because they had gotten, there had been a radio programmers convention on the Gold Coast in Australia at the same time as I Want You was racing up the Australian charts. And these American DJs took DAT tapes of the song home and started playing it on their radio stations. And then Rosie O'Donnell got her hand on it. And for about a week, you know, she used to have this wheel on her show with a red button in it. And periodically she would jump up in the middle of interviews and race over, say, I've got to do this, I've got to do this, and hit the red button and I Want You would come out. And at the same time, Columbia's trying to remix it, you know.
Wow.
So that's how the whole thing. So finally then the head of Columbia came down and said, look, just stop around, put the album out with it. And so they put the album out. As it was in Australia, I think there was two remixes across our universe and Truly Madly Deeply. And the rest of the album was exactly as it was in Australia. I mean, the remixes of I Want You were horrendous. It's horrible.
Yeah.
So we had a big hit in Australia probably about close to a year before it broke in America.
¶¶
It's incredible. I would love to know, what was your reaction when you found out it replaced Candle in the Wind as number one?
I didn't know it replaced Candle in the Wind. At one point, I think it jumped from like number six or something. So it had been a really big jump from where it was to number one. And all I know is I got a phone call from my good friend Kenny from New Jersey. He rang me up, woke me up at about 6 o'clock in the morning because, you know, for you guys, whatever time it is where you are, it's the same time all over the world, right? So he rings me up at 6 o'clock, and it was like 6 o'clock in the morning. Probably. It's number one. It's number one. And I'm going, what? What? You know, because I was half asleep. And I don't know what it replaced. I was just over the moon that it had got to number one. It's an amazing thing, to something you did, something you struggled with in your living room, and goes to number one in America for, you know, someone from Idaho. It's like, you know, it's a terrific thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Wonderful, Charles. Pressing on then, I'd love to know, when did you work with Olivia Newton-John and what was that experience like? I'd love to know.
I was living in America. I lived in America from about 99 to 2008. I lived in Los Angeles, and I think I can't remember what year that was, 2002 or 2003. Do you know what date that was?
I think that was 2002.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And she signed herself to an Australian label called Mushroom Records, a label based in Melbourne. And they didn't know. They rang me in Los Angeles and said, you want to do this record? It was a very simple, you know, I said, sure. And I went down and met her because she was living in Malibu. So we were neighbors in a funny way. And I just went down and met her, and we got on really well. I really liked her. You know, I was a little skeptical because we all know about, you know, Olivia Newton-John. And, you know, she was great. She was just, she had just such a great down-to-earth vibe. It was like, you know, it was just like meeting someone you went to school with. And she had this concept of doing a duets album. She wanted to just do duets with people that she liked. So, you know, I just really liked her. You know, we just clicked. So I said, okay. I mean, it was a very unlikely combination in a lot of ways. And I just said, okay. So we started assembling songs. But it was a very straight approach from the record company. And, you know, that obviously asked her. She'd obviously done her homework on me. And she was a big Savage Garden fan. And so, you know, it was just a gig to begin with. But she was just such a great lady. I mean, just fantastic lady. I mean, we did one flight. You know, we went all around the world doing this album. You know, we went to New York, we went to Nashville, and we went to Melbourne, we went to Sydney, we recorded in LA. We recorded everywhere because it was just duets with people she liked. At one point, the record company stuck us on an aeroplane from Melbourne to Sydney, and they screwed up somehow and they put her in economy. Our seats were at the back of the plane, like last row. So we got on the plane, we were walking down the aisleway, and all these people are looking, you know, it's Olivia Newton-John. They're all staring at us. We're walking down, and we sat down in the seats, and the host, the airline attendants came rushing up to her and said, oh, sorry, Olivia, you know, there's a spare seat up in business class. Do you want to come up? We'll upgrade. She said, no, I'm fine. She was just the most, you know, she walked to the studio every day. It was a 40-minute walk from a hotel. She was just, I just loved being with her. She was just a great lady. So I really enjoyed making the record. We work with some fabulous people. There's two or three songs on that record that are amongst my favorite things that I've ever done. I got to meet some fantastic people. You know, I got to see how the publishing business worked in America. We went and saw Diane Warren. She gave us a couple of songs that she'd written especially for us. You know, when we got to the studio, we realized at least four versions of that song that was specially written for us already released. You know, so I got to see some of the other sides of things that I had never been involved with before, because I really wasn't much of a song hunter in my career. I was very lucky. I tended to work with some really great songwriters, but it was a wonderful experience, you know, working with Keith Urban. I was with Keith Urban the day he got his first number one in Nashville on the country charts. We were sitting in the front lounge of, I forget what studio it was. But when we cut a track with him, and, you know, I just got to meet all these great people. And she was a fabulous person to work with, a great singer, really good singer. A lot of the tracks we did live with the two vocalists, and not overdubbing or anything. I got to make a couple of tracks with dead people, which was interesting. You know, we got the track that we did with Johnny O'Keefe, who was an Australian singer who'd, you know, passed away about 20 years ago. And they gave us a mono tape, and I had to get rid of all the music and just extract his voice somehow. Wow. So that gave me some good technical expertise, which ended up sounding great, you know. So it was a great experience.
Well, that's wonderful, Charles. Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, I'm curious of any production students that might end up listening to our interview here. And out of service to them, I'm curious if you had any advice you'd care to give.
Well, you know, listen to everything that you can and analyze everything that you like and try and work out what's going on, you know, who's playing, what's being played, why it's being played. And, you know, I believe as a producer in serving the song, I think, you know, a lot of people think the producer can be there to realize the artist's vision, to help the artist realize his vision. I think that is what most people think that their job as a producer is. You know, here you've got this great songwriter, great singer, and you're there to help him turn his vision of this song into a record. And I think that that's only partially true. I think what's the best way you can serve your artist is to serve your artist's material, to serve the song, to concentrate on making sure that what the artist is doing with that song is the best that can happen. So I have this theory of serve the song. And if it means that you have to go head to head with the artist over what is going on, go head to head with the artist. You are not helping anyone if you do something you fundamentally think is wrong. I think conflict in a creative situation is really productive. And you are, as a producer, in a sense, in a collaborative environment. You know, you're not working alone. You are, in a sense, in a collaborative environment. So in any collaborative environment, if you don't fight for what you think is right, you're not really being of any help to anybody. So, you know, my theory is serve the song. And that's the best advice that I can give any young producer. Don't lose sight of the fact that you're supposed to be making a good record. And if that good record is not exactly what the artist had in mind, right, then you don't serve anyone by giving. Savage Garden, one of the reasons I didn't continue working with them is that we had a lot of creative differences making that record. They didn't want drums on it, and they didn't want guitars on it. And the whole direction of that record, we had creative differences over. They wanted to make a very electronic record. They wanted the record to sound very urban. And, you know, I didn't think that an urban record with a couple of young boys from Brisbane was going to make any sense to anybody. So I didn't want to make an urban record. I didn't mind urban influences, but I wanted to make a record that sounded like Blade Runner. In other words, there were so many different influences in there that you couldn't really put your finger on it. Mm. It's a pop record. That's what pop is. Popular music takes all the influences that are existing at any particular point of time or have existed and mush it together into a stew. That's what pop music is. And had I given in to them, and we wouldn't have had the album that we had, I believe. We wouldn't have had drums. We wouldn't have had guitars. We wouldn't have had a pop record. We'd have had, I believe we would have probably ended up with, you know, a poor man's Thriller.
Wow.
So I think it's really important that you stick to your guns and you serve the songs. And I don't even think those boys will remember the conflicts that we had, because the artist doesn't. Once the song becomes a hit, most of them don't remember the conflict.
Interesting. You know? Yeah.
It's like childbirth, you know. If you hang on to the pain of childbirth, you'll never have another kid. You know?
Right, right.
You remember the joy of the birth. You don't remember the pain to get there. And it's the same with making a record, you know.
Yeah.
You've probably heard that analogy a million times, that Sure. Making a record is like giving birth to a song. You don't remember the pain. So if the process is painful, stick with, you know.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be worthwhile.
Absolutely. That's well said, Charles. Thank you so much. Well, Charles Fisher, how can people find out about you, sir?
Oh, well, you can look up my website, www.charlesfisherproducer.com, and you'll probably find out everything that you need to know. And you can contact me through that. You can see what I've done. You can see what I look like. You can see how the years have been not necessarily kind to me. But I am a very happy man.
That's all that matters in the end of it.
It's all that matters.
Charles, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time for me. It meant a lot to me.
You're welcome, Josh. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.